Well, good morning and welcome. If you're a guest, this is a great morning for you to be here because we are going to the heart of the gospel the next few weeks. We are starting a series. We've been going through the Gospel of John for a year now, but this is a series leading up to Easter on what Jesus went through, why he did it, and what it means for the world and for you. In fact, at the end of this series, right after Easter, we will have Baptism Sunday. For anyone who wants to put their faith in the Lord, that's going to be happening the Sunday after Easter, after we talk about what the cross means and what it means for you. Okay, so my wife and I, we have five kids, and their generation is wonderful and weird, especially when it comes to language, right? So you probably heard Riz. That gets thrown around all the time. Anybody heard Skibbity? Yeah, and all its variations, Skibbity Toilet, Skibbity Ohio. It means absolutely nothing, and everybody knows what it means. That's the way my 16-year-old described it to me, which doesn't make any sense. They have other words. Glazing, you're stop glazing me, or a mogging. And unlike my generation, who had totally normal words like psych, my kids call me Big Back all the time, which I think means I'm really muscular. Anyway, one of the phrases Gen Z has is actually really helpful for this morning. It's if you're saying, like, I'm a superstar, I'm the best in the world at something, you go, I'm, that's right. It's the best translation for what Jesus says in the Gospel of John this morning. I'm him. So turn your Bibles to John 18. We're going to start in verse 1. I just want to camp out in verse 1 for 1 minute because it sets the context. Jesus, all of this happens in a garden. It's called the Garden of Gethsemane. But the first verse says, when he had finished praying, Jesus left his disciples and crossed to the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. When he had finished praying, the prayer that he prays right before he goes to the garden, we looked at a few months ago. It's Jesus' last prayer, and it's for us. He prays that the body of Christ would show the world what he was like by our unity. That we would, in other words, reflect the nature of God by the way we loved and cared for each other, crossing all different kinds of lines of the way we're divided by the world. I love that prayer. One of the things we say around PV is, how many churches are there in Little Rock? There's one church. This used to matter a lot to us as a tribe, as a fellowship. We started as a unity movement. We were the first non-denominational Christians. We were pretty good at being non-denominational and being a unity movement. We didn't want to be the only Christians. We wanted to be Christians only. But human beings, being what human beings are, sin got in. And sin is still sin, even if it hides behind religious stained glass. And after a generation, we went from being a unity movement to being pretty sectarian. We would say things like, we thought we were the only ones who were saved. And frankly, we weren't sure about all of us. But God, in his great mercy, I think, has delivered us from that. I think most of our fellowship has again gotten in touch with this prayer from Jesus. And if you still struggle with this, or if you're listening to this and you belong to a church that is still sectarian, here's what I would encourage you to do. Start praying for the other churches in your city. And you might think, well, Jonathan, but they're wrong on some stuff. Yeah, so are we. And if God reveals that to us, we'll change our mind. But pray for other churches, that God would bless them and that God would use them to reach people who are far from him, because we're not saved. None of us are saved by getting all our theology right. If that was the case, Jesus wouldn't have to have done this. In verse 2 of chapter 18 of the Gospel of John, now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers. Remember that phrase, detachment. and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches and lanterns and weapons, and Jesus knew all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. And again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. Jesus answered, "I told you, I am he. If you're looking for me, then let these men go." This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. "I have not lost one of those you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who won a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me?" And then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and they brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. So Judas leads a detachment of soldiers to the garden where Jesus is. Like all human beings, they are looking for God. They just don't know that. And I want you to notice the very first thing Jesus says. It's an odd pairing of phrases. John says, knowing everything that was going to happen, Jesus asked, "What do you want?" He knows the answer. Why does he ask? Here's what I want you to see. In the Gospel of John, over and over again, Jesus forces us to make a decision about who he is. And in our modern world, one of the challenges we have is we make so many choices. We feel like choice overload. And so what a lot of us do is when it comes to stuff, especially the really weighty stuff that really matters, we're just like, I don't know who could decide, you know, so we don't decide. But you do know that to not decide is itself a decision. For example, if you are ambivalent or hard to decide on if you're going to save for retirement, and you just go through your life kind of waffling, I don't know if it's wise or not, or I don't know if it should or worth the sacrifice. In 3 decades, when you finish your career, if you have not been able to decide whether or not to save for retirement, you have in fact made a decision. And when you retire, you will find that you don't have anything to retire on. So Jesus is constantly forcing a decision for us. He knows, and yet he asks. And the reason he does this is because he's wanting you to face the existential question of your life, if Jesus is who he says he is. What do you do with me? So Jesus is not an exit ramp, or Jesus is not like a mile marker on the side of the interstate. He is an exit ramp. And if you do not follow him, you are going to go where the highway is going. So what I want you to see, and this sermon was heavily influenced by the pastor, Tim Keller. Here's how he divides up or points out what God is doing in this text. First off, today I want you to see the greatest claim in the history of the world. And second, about the greatest problem in our world. And third, the greatest mission in the history of the world. First, the greatest claim. When Jesus says, "I'm him," when he says, "I am he," in the Greek, what he actually said, the word "he" isn't in there. It had to be in there for our translations just to make sense to readers today. But what Jesus actually says is 2 Greek words, "ego am I." Let me hear you say, "ego am I." It means "I am." And if you're familiar with the Bible, then there's this other story that makes you think of, because in the book of Exodus, early on, God comes to Moses, who is this like, he's a shepherd at the time. He tells Moses, "I want you to go to Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world, and tell him to let the Israelite slaves go." And Moses knows he has no authority to go to Pharaoh and say anything. So he says to this voice coming from a bush, "Who do I say sent me?" And the voice, God, says, "Tell Pharaoh the I am." In other words, I am. We don't use the verb to be like this, but here's what God is saying. I am not contingent on anything. I am not dependent on anything. All things are sustained by me. right? That's what God is. Jesus actually talks like this in the Gospel of John. Earlier in John chapter 8, he's in an argument with his religious opponents, and they're talking about Abraham. And Jesus, it's a mic drop kind of moment. Jesus goes, before Abraham existed, I am. Abraham was like 2,000 years ago. What do you mean, Jesus? God's name, Jesus is saying he is God. He is taking God's name on himself. There's no beginning to me. There's no ending to me. There's no because to me. I do not depend on anything or anyone. All things, all persons depend on me. In the words of the Gospel of John, in him all things were made and through him all things are. This is a problem for us in Western culture because Jesus is saying something here that no other founder of any other religion ever said. In fact, in some ways, it's the opposite. Like people like Moses and Muhammad and Buddha, they said things like, this is the way to the truth, or this is the way to the best kind of life. Jesus says things differently. He doesn't say, this is the way to the truth, the way to the life. He says, I am the way and the truth and the life. The other founders of every other faith say, I've come to show you the way to God. Jesus says, nope, I am God in the flesh, come to find you. Those are entirely different ways of approaching the Lord. One way of thinking in America is that all the world religions are kind of the same, equally bad or equally good. And we think generally that if a religion is really old, then it's probably been around for a while and it can help people. So you have to decide which one of the many. But if Jesus really is who he says he is, then it's fundamentally different than everything else that's out there. And it is a secular kind of myth that all world religions are basically the same. That, by the way, is equally offensive to all world religions. But if Jesus is who he says he is, then it's not just that Christianity is in a whole different venue. It's that the other world religions are irrelevant. But maybe he's not. I'll grant you. I mean, we're taking this by faith. But here are the options if he's not. If he isn't who he says he is, then he's a liar. I mean, he's a really big, bald-faced liar. If he is who he says he is, and he honestly believed it, but he's not that, then he's crazy. He's a lunatic. You should despise this. You should run away from it. A lot of times in the modern world, we say things like, you know, I don't believe Jesus was God, but I find his teachings inspiring. And if that's you today, I'm not trying to pick on you, but you probably haven't read his teachings. Let me just show you a couple of things. There's a time where Jesus says to the religious leaders that he's in an argument with, he says, you know what? I keep sending you prophets and sages, and you keep killing them. And then you'll, you know, turn around after you've killed them, and you'll have a holiday to commemorate them. Okay, did you hear this? This guy, this is a 33-year-old guy saying, I keep sending you prophets. You know, that's been like thousands of years. Who does this guy think he is? The prophets like had lived hundreds and thousands of years ago. There's a time where Jesus sends out the disciples and they come back and they're telling all the stuff that God had been doing in their ministry. And Jesus says, I saw Satan fall like lightning. Where were you standing, Jesus? If he really said this kind of stuff, it's not just the kind of stuff that you dismiss as a good teacher who, you know, had an off day. Somebody who actually put this really well was Bono, the lead singer for U2. A few years ago, he was being interviewed by a journalist who was talking about his music and everything, but because Jesus Christ is really central to Bono, the journalist brought him up and said, you know, Jesus Christ is one of the greatest teachers and thinkers in the history of the world, which is true. But he said, Son of God, don't you think that's far-fetched? And Bono shot back, no, it's not far-fetched. The secular response to the Christian story always goes like this. He was a great prophet. He had a lot of good things to say along the lines of others like Muhammad and Buddha and Confucius. So he's engaging with the kind of worldview that I was just describing. But Jesus does not allow you to say that. Christ says, don't call me a teacher or a prophet. I'm saying I'm God incarnate. So we are left with really this. Either Christ is who he said he is, or he's a complete nutcase on the level of Charles Manson, and I'm not joking here. The idea that the entire globe, one half of the human race, has had its history completely changed by a nutcase, for me, that's far-fetched. I think he's right. What do you do with Jesus? This is the decision point. Okay, maybe you think, okay, he's not a liar, he's not a lunatic, but he is a legend, because come on, God doesn't become a human being. God doesn't allow himself to get crucified, and, you know, resurrections don't happen. Okay, I understand that, but I've tried carefully over the last year as we engage the Gospel of John to show you what John thought he was doing. John really did think he was writing the first century kind of history. He's not making a myth. He's telling you what really happened. A book I've recommended several times in this series is by Richard Bauckham, a world-class scholar. It's called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And what he wants us to see here, every time that John quotes someone, gives you a name, he's doing that for a reason. It's because these people are eyewitnesses and they're still living. That's how first century historians wrote their stuff. So for example, Malchus, who got his ear cut off, we're going to engage in that story a little bit more. But when John tells you his name, he's not an important character. There's way more important people in the gospel in first century Israel that Jesus interacted with, and John doesn't tell you their names. John is trying to intentionally give you these names so that they're still living. You can go talk to them. Trust me, Malchus remembers this part of the story. That's what John is doing. So he really is trying to do first century history because he's wanting you to know this is an eyewitness account. If Jesus really made these claims and he's right, here's what you do. You fall on your knees and you say, command me. You say to Jesus, the answer is yes. Now what's the question? Or you have nothing to do with him. It's all made up. Or maybe Jesus is evil or a megalomaniac. Those are your options. This is what the Gospel of John is bringing us to, a decision point. Okay, back to the story. Simon Peter pulls out a sword and chops off Malchus's ear. Now, a thing a lot of us forget is what Jesus had just done was communion with the disciples when he prayed that priestly prayer. But communion was Passover. Jesus was celebrating Passover with the disciples. And Passover was honored by you drank four cups of wine. This is why the disciples are sleepy after, you know, while Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. So when Peter comes out, he's probably groggy and grumpy, and he pulls a sword, and he's not swinging for the guy's ear. You know that, right? Like, he's not Zorro. He's trying to make his head a canoe. And he misses and gets the ear. And in Luke's gospel, we find out that Jesus reached down, picked the ear up, and put it back on, which is a clue for Malchus. This is a bad idea. This is getting off to a bad start. Imagine being Malchus. You're just there like, I love this story so much. You're just there arresting Jesus. And the next thing, you're in the crowd. The next thing you know, your ear is, you know, it's successfully been on your head this entire life. And now it's your head's on fire and you look down and your ear is on the ground. And while you're trying to figure out what just happened, the guy you're arresting bends down, picks it up, puts it back on, and then just moves on. Like that's a totally normal thing. Meanwhile, you're thinking, did he put it on right? Is it straight? Is one higher than the other? You're the most insecure person for the rest of your life. Every time you have a conversation with someone, you're just, you know, trying to show them your good side or whatever. That's Malchus. Malchus remembers this. Go ask him about it, the Gospel of John is saying. And all throughout this chapter, John is showing us that what Jesus had said about himself was true. That what he prophesied, what he promised was going to happen. And at the same time, he lets you hear voices like the high priest Caiaphas. Because Caiaphas thinks he's in charge of this thing. And John is letting you know Jesus is running the show. Caiaphas looks like he's in control. Jesus is in control. In the Gospel of John, no one kills Jesus. He lays down his life. And in this moment, when they say they're looking for Jesus of Nazareth, he says, "Ego am I am," and they all fall down. What is happening? The word for detachment of soldiers is it means 200. This was like an actual way of describing a troop of Roman soldiers. These are battle-hardened guys. They're tough guys. They've been through war. They're going to arrest a meek, mild carpenter. He stands up and says, "Ego am I," and they fall down. Why? This is a thing that happens over and over again in the Bible. When God's presence shows up, people hit the ground. They can't keep their footing. Like, look at Ezekiel. Ezekiel, the prophet, when God shows up, He's knocked flat. In 2 Chronicles 5, when they're dedicating the temple for the first time, and the Spirit of God, the Shekinah glory of God, falls in the temple, everybody hits the ground. When Peter first sees Jesus in Luke 5, Jesus helps him catch fish, and that's when Peter realizes, oh, I'm not just talking to any man. And Peter falls on his face and says, "Get away from me, Lord, I'm a sinner," which is exactly what people do. Like Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, when he is in the presence of God, all of a sudden he's very aware of his own sin. This is a prophet. This is one of the good guys. And all of a sudden he's aware of his own sin and says, "Get away from me, God, I'm coming undone." This whole idea that's maybe foreign to a kind of secular worldview is that there is a God, and this God is greater than you. And when you are in his presence, you come undone. You can't stand. And before Jesus lays his glory aside, he gives them just a little glimpse, kind of a little flex. And 200 hardened soldiers hit the floor. And Jesus is like, "Come on, guys, get up. I can't arrest myself. This is embarrassing." Because when you're in the presence of something infinitely greater than you, you're knocked off your feet. And what the Bible is saying over and over again is this happens. In our world, so many of us are tempted by being the kind of spiritual but not religious, which I get that. But one of the downsides to that is there's this tendency to focus on God as like a therapeutic device or a warm, fuzzy blanket or a feeling of love, which, by the way, that's all, you know, I think God does help help people get healthy and whole. All that's true. I think God is love. I think there is an experience of love in God. That's only part of God. Listen, for some of y'all, this is going to be really interesting, and I want you to chase it in your own time. Like, Google this. This is a Latin phrase. It's called the mysterium tremendum. This is how theologians have described people having encounters and experiences with God. And it's rarely just warm fuzzies. In fact, there is an article. I was looking for it. It's 10 years old now, but 10 years ago in the New York Times, there was an article written by a woman who was an atheist, and she's still an atheist when she wrote this. What made the article disorienting is that she, as an atheist, went into great detail, even wrote a book about she encountered the presence of God for hours one night. She does not pretend that it wasn't that. She described it, yes, it was part of feeling love and joy, but she described it as feeling fear and awe and even holy terror. For hours, she was in her bedroom experiencing the presence of God. And when the smoke cleared from that encounter, she did not like it. She never wants to experience it again. This is one of the things I think American Christians miss. The mysterious tremendum. There is a God. And this God is not bound by our human understandings of him. And when we encounter this God truly, we, like the people who have gone before us, are undone. Why is this? Pastor Tim Keller actually said, think about how much self-deceit is in all of us. All the ways we lie to ourselves about ourselves and the things going on. Think about how fragile our egos are. For example, if you don't get that job, or you can't get into that club or that college or, you know, whatever it is that everybody else is getting in. Think about all the ways we lie to ourselves about why we do what we do to each other. And when you stand in the presence of capital T truth, your lies dissolve away. No one can stand in the presence of God. Over and over again in the Bible, when people meet God, they hit the ground suddenly aware of their own inadequacies and failures. They have come into the presence of something greater than them. And God, often without saying anything about the judgment of their sin, they are highly aware of it. And yet I'm convinced this is what every person is truly hungry for. The glory and the presence and power of God in their life. That's why Jesus came and what he came to give us. And do you notice what Jesus seemed to say he was up to? It's to face the greatest problem in the world and then send us on our great mission. What Jesus says he's up to, when Peter takes a swing at Malchus, Jesus says, Peter, put the sword back up. And then he says, shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? Now, this might be a little bit foreign, but what he's talking about is justice and judgment. In the prophets in the Old Testament, when they talk about God righting everything, God making things whole, God, you know, ending the tyrant's reign, ending the oppression, ending all the things that we've done to each other, when God talks about that, he talks about it in the cup of judgment. And he will pour out his anger on all those injustices until they are rectified. And Jesus steps in and says, I'll drink that cup. That's the metaphor that's happening here. Jesus and Peter, they are Jewish. They know that metaphor. I will drink the cup of judgment. Now, here's the interesting thing. In our culture, we talk so much about justice these days, which is a really good thing. But have you noticed we're really struggling to define it? And what's interesting to me in our secular world is we're so highly attuned to justice and fairness. And yet, the worldview of the secular person is there is no real judgment day. And all these injustices are never going to be rectified. However, traditional religion says, oh, there is a judgment day. The judge is going to be here, so you better be good. Or you better get church right, or whatever it is. That's not this story either. You know what the gospel says? What John is telling us right here, there is going to be a judgment day, but the judge came to earth and was judged in our place. Jesus Christ is the judge who was judged. Why? He says it right here. He doesn't want to lose anyone. So on judgment day, you can stand before God on your feet because you will be accepted in Jesus. When the soldiers arrived, all the disciples are in danger. These are 200 battle-hardened Roman soldiers. And let me tell you how they dealt with insurrectionists in the day. If you're an insurrectionist leading a revolt against Rome, they're going to squash that pretty quick, and they're going to go after your leader, Jesus, but then they're going to go after all his loyal followers. Now they're down to 11, 12 with Jesus versus 200. That's why they come at night. They're thinking there's going to be a little battle skirmish. So that's the protocol they're following. And if they would have arrested Jesus' 11 disciples, no one would have ever heard from them again. And Jesus very deliberately says, is it me you're looking for? Then leave them alone. Forgive them. Leave them out of it. If we really believe this is true about what Jesus does and why Jesus does it, it'd change the way you could live right now. Some of us are pretty fragile. When criticism comes, when people put us down or don't believe in us or don't believe in our future, does that crush you? It doesn't have to. Because part of what the Gospel of John, and it's been saying this over and over again in a lot of different ways, part of what the Gospel of John is saying, who cares what popular opinion thinks? Who cares what they think? You're not on trial anymore. The verdict that it's in Jesus, you are not guilty. You are accepted because of Jesus. The question of your worth has been taken out of your hands and decided in your favor because of what Jesus did on the cross. The judge became judged. The king became the servant. The I am died the death of a slave. So what are you going to do with that? It is a decision point. It is your greatest problem. It is why Jesus died. And if you have accepted his faith and his life, it is your greatest mission. There's a guy that I learned about in college, missionary, the first American missionary. His name was Adoniram Judson. He had a strange path to becoming the first American missionary. He went to Burma, the nation that is currently named Burma. He was the first missionary there. When he got there, there was no Christians at all. And when he left there, there were over 7,000. It was a hard ministry role for Judson. He lost his wife and several of his children doing this. But the path that he took to becoming a missionary is what was interesting to me. He grew up in a Christian home, but his faith was pretty fragile. And he went to Brown University, and during his first few months, he fell in with his best friend was this philosophy student named Jacob Eames, and Jacob Eames did not believe. He was a philosopher who rejected all religion, rejected the Bible. In fact, he ridiculed the God of the Bible, and Judson's faith, which was already fragile, crumbled. He no longer believed. He didn't tell his family about it until the day he graduated Brown University as valedictorian. He announced to his family he was no longer a Christian, and since he was a gifted writer and he wanted to do playwriting, he moved to New York City where he did playwriting for several years. But he found that empty and not ultimately fulfilling. And one day he was traveling back from New York City, and he stayed in an inn, and the person who checked him in said, "We only have one room available, and it is next to a man who is dying. Probably won't live through the night." Judson said, "I'll take the room. I need a place to stay." And sure enough, all night long, he heard the cries of this man in the room next to him. And it provoked a kind of existential crisis for Judson. He began to wonder, is this man prepared for death? Am I prepared for death? His philosophy since college had made him think that, you know, death was nothing but a door into an empty pit. But that didn't bring a lot of comfort when you're actually in a room next to someone dying. And at the same time, he could hear the voice of his college friend, Jacob Eames, you know, mocking him. Is this really all it takes for you to have to go back to religion for comfort? You're this weak? Aren't you the valedictorian of Brown University? Look at you being spooked by some superstitious religion. And he lay there in bed, waffling between fear and shame for feeling that fear. Finally, the voice stopped. And the next morning, the sun came up, and the despair Judson was going through was lifted. And he went to the clerk at the hotel or at the inn desk and asked him about the man next door. And they said, "Well, he died last night." And he said, "Do you know who it was?" And they said, "Yes. Young man from the college down the street. His name is Jacob Eames." Again, this is a true story. And Judson couldn't believe it. He didn't leave the inn for the rest of the day, and he wrote this at the end of the day, "Lost in death." Jacob Eames was lost, utterly, irrevocably lost. Lost to his friends, to the world, to the future. Lost as a puff of smoke is lost in the infinity of the air. Lost in death, Jacob Eames was lost. Hold on. If Eames' own views were true, neither his life nor the life of nor his death had any meaning. But suppose Eames had been mistaken. Suppose the scriptures were literally true and a personal God real. For that hell should open in that country inn and snatch Jacob Eames, my dearest friend and guide, from the next bed. This could not, simply could not be coincidence. And Judson would shortly come thereafter not only to believe the gospel, but also to pour out his life for it. The gospel of Jesus was no light thing for him. It was weighty and life and death. It demanded the utmost attention and the greatest devotion because it is the greatest mission. And so the question Jesus asked today is, what are you going to do with him? You have to decide. You have to give a verdict. Is he the Lord? Have you surrendered to him? Because there's no middle ground in the Gospel of John in the life of Jesus. Have you believed his message? He paid a debt for you through his life and death that you must have if you're going to be with God for eternity. And if you've never made that decision, I want to invite you to do it today. I want to invite our prayer teams to take their places around the auditorium. They're godly men and women. If you want to, you can take a first step in growing deeper in the Lord or putting him on in baptism for the first time. Jesus can change your life. Jesus makes your life better and makes you better at life. And he forces us to come to a decision point about him. Let's do that now while together we stand and